You're listening to WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, in keeping with yesterday's theme, look at the organization called Compassionate Friends. Part two, something lighter, from comedy writer Chris Harris. If you heard yesterday's morning show, then you heard my conversation with Nisha Zenoff, the author of a remarkable book called The Unspeakable Loss, How Do You Live After a Child Dies? More than once in the course of this book, in which Nisha Zenoff talks about her own loss and also the similar loss suffered by other parents who've lost a child, she makes mention of the single most important agency for supporting parents who have suffered this kind of loss. They're called the Compassionate Friends. And this organization has 600 chapters located throughout all 50 states, plus Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, and Guam. And they offer a number of different resources and services and a sense of community for parents who have suffered this exceptionally tough loss. I'm very grateful to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Debbie Rambus, who is executive director of the Compassionate Friends and someone who herself has also suffered this kind of loss. And we will be talking with her about her own story and about all that Compassionate Friends has to offer those who find themselves dealing with this kind of sorrow. Debbie Rambus, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I always appreciate any opportunity I get that I can talk about the Compassionate Friends in hopes that we reach all that need us.
Right. Very good. I know someone in my life for whom your organization has made a very significant difference in terms of her coping with her own loss. If you don't mind, I think it's probably important for us to maybe begin with your own story. And I know that it involves your son, whose name was Tony. Can you tell us about Tony and what happened to Tony?
Sure. We had moved to Savannah, Georgia for a job. I worked for the government at the time. And we were living what we thought was the perfect life. We grew up in Midwestern Indiana, and we had the opportunity. We were living on an island, on a golf course with a pool, and our youngest son was there with us. He was 29 years old and just a happy-go-lucky guy. He went to Purdue University for a number of years. In fact, we didn't know if he'd ever leave. He loved Purdue so much, went there for 6 years. He was a pilot. He just loved life. I happened to be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, for my job at the time. It was March 2nd, 2011, and Tony was going to clean our pool for us. My husband retired from the Army and was a public school teacher, and my daughter, who is disabled, was home with Tony, and he was out cleaning the pool. And for reasons unknown to us, he drowned. The best guess the coroner could give us was that he had some sort of heart event, and you know, our life, just as everyone's life who's lost a child, a grandchild, a brother, a sister, was never to be the same again. So we miss him every day. I think about him. I still talk to him. I parent him. So he's still with me in my heart.
How long ago was it that this occurred to Tony?
In 2011, so 6 years ago.
Right. So it's a loss that still is very close to you, I should think. I wonder if you could just talk about that element of uncertainty that you mentioned that surrounds his death, the fact that it is a little bit hard to know just precisely what happened. I ask that in part because this is sometimes the reality. In fact, that's the reality of Nisha Zenoff, the author I mentioned in the introduction, that the circumstances around which her son Victor was killed in a climbing accident are very, very murky. And we talked a little bit about how that element of uncertainty can sometimes be an aggravating factor in what already is a very hard sorrow. Do you think that was a source of additional difficulty for you and your husband, for instance?
Yeah, for us, yes, it was difficult because regardless of how your loved one goes, you want answers. And you think in your mind, though it may be irrationally, that if you had the answers, you'd be able to understand. And really, any time a child goes before their parents or grandparents or brother or sister, your world is just turned upside down. So yes, not knowing, we thought, oh, as soon as we get the autopsy results, we'll be able to understand this. We had speculated all different kinds of scenarios. Maybe he had gotten hit in the head with a golf ball. Maybe there was some foul play. You know, your mind runs rampant. But really, even after we got the autopsy results, it just said he drowned. And so speaking with the coroner, he said his best guess was a heart event. So really, there weren't any answers, as so many people face. And even if there are answers, even if your child has died because of a specific cause, your world making sense of it, it doesn't make sense because it's not the natural order of things. So it is a process. It is difficult work to work through this grief to make sense of our world again.
Hmm. So for you, what was most important? In terms of helping you to survive a loss like this? I mean, what was the sorrow like in the immediate wake of this event? And what was most important to you in being able to, in a sense, survive such a loss?
Well, I think most immediately I have two other children. I wanted them near me because, you know, things that you took for granted aren't taken for granted anymore. And I wanted to ensure they were safe. And so the only place that I felt safe initially was in my home. And then after being there a short while, and, you know, the rest of the world getting back to what they do, then I didn't feel safe in my home anymore. I didn't want to be there. So it really what I was doing was searching and trying to find my comfort. So, you know, friends and family, they call, they're wonderful, but their lives go on and you're still left with the hurt and the pain and figuring out, how am I going to live with this? And so we tried a number of different things. We tried some group therapies, not through Compassionate Friends, but other organizations. And I couldn't relate because they were different types of death. They'd lost a parent or a grandparent. Kind of, even though those are difficult, they're still kind of the natural order of things. So that didn't work for us. We tried a number of counselors that were helpful. We went and, you know, they helped us little bits here and there. But still, it just didn't seem like a fit. And so one day, a friend of a friend had mentioned the Compassionate Friend. So we looked them up online, and we found there was an organization for us. So we were very excited about that. But unfortunately, when I called the number that was listed for Savannah, the woman that answered was very, very nice, and she understood, and she herself had lost a child. However, she told me there wasn't a chapter in Savannah. And so I was once again, I was just devastated. But I did learn that there was a national conference that they conduct once a year. And it happened to be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I had been when I heard the news of Tony. So we loaded our car in July and went to that conference. And I have to say, that was the first time in being around other parents, grandparents, brothers, and sisters that I knew we were going to be all right.
Hmm. What sorts of things occurred at that event in the Twin Cities?
You know, every year, this year we're going to be in St. Louis in July. It's just, if you can imagine, 1,400 families there about, all having lost a child from what, at any age, from any cause. And they have keynote speakers. There are workshops that you can go to. You select the topics that you want to learn about. It could be anything from preserving the legacy of your child to coping with losing your only child to a grandparent's grief, just all kinds of workshops throughout the days, Friday and Saturday, and then sharing sessions of an evening. And then on Sunday, there is a walk to remember where we have signs of our loved ones, little yard signs that we put along the walk that has their picture and their name, and we all walk together in remembrance of our children. So it's a wonderful event. I tell you, it is much like I say every year, that's our vacation with Tony, because we take him right along with us. We wear a button. They give you buttons. They'll make you a button with a picture of your child. And people want to hear about them. They want to hear your story. They'll see the picture and say, oh, that's a handsome young man. Can you tell me about him? And it's just a comfort that we don't get from the outside world.
Hmm. We're speaking with Debbie Rambus, who is executive director of the organization that she was just describing, called the Compassionate Friends, which is the country's most important organization expressly for parents who have suffered the death of a child. So explain how you have come to be executive director of Compassionate Friends. What is, in a sense, your history with this organization, beginning with that first encounter in the Twin Cities?
Okay, well, you know, as I said, they have workshops at this conference, and one workshop was how to start a chapter. So my husband and I went to that workshop, and I thought, you know, if we could prevent one other family from hearing, I'm sorry, there isn't a chapter, I wanted to do that. So we started a chapter in Savannah, Georgia, and by December of that year, we had our candlelighting. We participated in the worldwide candlelighting, which is this Sunday, December 10th. And so from there, we just got more and more involved, because one thing that we also found is that helping is healing. So even though we were still early in our grief journey, by helping others, by telling our story, by listening to theirs, by getting to know their children, we were healing as well. Now, that doesn't mean you ever get over losing a child, But it's much like when you put on a backpack that weighs 40 pounds, initially it's very heavy and you wonder, how am I ever going to walk with this? But you learn to and you get accustomed to it, and before too long, you're walking okay with it. And that's kind of like the grief journey. We became regional coordinators helping other chapters. And then we decided we would move away from Savannah to near where our son lives in Houston, Texas. So we picked up and we moved. We started another chapter here. We became regional coordinators in Texas. I became one of the board members. And then most recently, the opportunity presented itself that there was going to be an opening for the executive director. And honestly, it is my life's passion now to help as many families as I can so that no one need walk alone. And so I had a great government job, had worked for 32 years for the government. My husband and I discussed it, and we decided we're going to do this. And I say we, you know, he's still a school teacher, but it really is a family commitment. So that's how I became executive director. I applied, went through the interview process, and thankfully was selected.
Hmm. So explain the most important sorts of help and resources that Compassionate Friends have to offer to a parent who has suffered this kind of loss.
You know, there isn't a one-way-fits-all. There isn't a one-size-fits-all with grief. So we have a number of different resources. As you indicated, we have 600 chapters that meet monthly nationwide. And what they do is they get together, you share your story, and then there's a topic. So you learn who you can depend upon within your community. But that's not for everyone. Not everyone likes getting, you know, meeting people, going face-to-face. Sometimes there's young families that they've got to get a babysitter, and that's not convenient. We also offer 25 closed Facebook pages. And those closed Facebook pages allow you the opportunity to be online and connect with others with a similar loss. For example, we have sudden death, a Compassionate Friend's sudden death. We have loss to cancer. We have loss by suicide. We have a men in grief, so that it's only men in that closed Facebook group. And the luxury of the closed Facebook group is the fact that you can type and say what you feel in your heart, and it's not going on your own personal page. The whole world doesn't have to know. And we know not everyone's on Facebook. So what we do is we also have on our webpage, you can go there at compassionatefriends.org, and you can look up chat rooms. And chat rooms, it's our online community where you sit at the computer one-on-one with a small group of individuals and you type your comments. We also have a number of webinars. We partner with Open to Hope, and they publish webinars for us. Right now, this month, this is on Facebook, and we'll be posting it on our webpage. We're doing 31 messages of hope, because the holidays are especially difficult when you've lost a child. Everyone around you is happy and jolly, and you go into a store and strangers say, you know, happy holidays, and coworkers may ask you, what are you doing with your family? And you know, we put on kind of a mask and we say it back, you know, happy holidays, and oh, it's going to be a quiet one this year. Our 31 messages of hope that we're publishing are just 2 to 3 minute videos where, you know, we have different people, siblings, grandparents, parents, people of all ages, saying, what is their message of hope? How did they find hope? So we try a number of things at different times of year so that we can support anyone, anywhere.
I saw on your website a couple of different things that people had written specifically around the Thanksgiving holiday and the fact that in these moments when most of us are busy giving thanks, a day like that can be especially difficult because amidst all the things you are grateful for, of course, is this, in a sense, this gaping hole in your heart. And this very painful loss, a loss that maybe has been with you a long time or a very new loss. What's been most helpful to you and your husband in terms of making it through the holidays, which, as you said, can be especially challenging for someone who has suffered this kind of loss?
I think my best advice is to be easy on yourself. And in that, I mean, have an escape plan. So maybe traditionally you get together at a friend's house or a family's house, have a pre-thought, a way, an excuse, whatever you want to use so that if it becomes uncomfortable, that it's okay to leave. It may even include letting the host know that, you know, I'm going to give this a try. However, I want you to know that I may need to slip out. And would you please just make an excuse for me? And then if you don't feel like doing something, don't force yourself. You know, you've got to give yourself some time. Another thing that we do is we try to incorporate Tony still, and we always will. We always, before our Thanksgiving dinner, before our Christmas dinner, we form a circle, we light a candle, we say a few words, like he has a niece and three nephews that were very young at the time, and they don't have their own personal memories so much of Tony, but we talk about Tony, and we tell them about their Uncle Tony and things that he liked and he enjoyed, and they can point to pictures, and they can tell you stories about Tony. So he lives on not only through us, but through them. Give yourself time to get plenty of rest. It's so important. And don't should yourself. I should do this. I should do that. I should be thinking this. Don't do that to yourself. It's okay. It's grief is hard work. And I don't think as a society we recognize that and we allow people that time they need to do that hard work. And it, you know, it's been since 2011 for me. I still have tears. I still think of Tony every day, and I always will. So don't think I need to get over this. You're not going to get over it. You carry it with you, and you will always, always have the memory of your loved one.
As I think about the loss that that you have experienced and others who are part of Compassionate Friends, I think of a friend of mine who has been gone for a while now. She was an older woman and a very kind friend to me when I first moved to the area and first started working here at the radio station. This woman had actually suffered this loss twice. She lost one of her sons, John, when he was a fairly young boy. And then about 10 years later, and actually on the same date, she lost her other son, Douglas. And I, of course, never knew either of them. In fact, the first loss she suffered before I was even born. So this is decades later that I met this remarkable woman who lived such a vibrant life. And just to meet her immediately, you would never guess that there was this heavy overcast of sorrow that was part of who she was. Although once you got to know her, this was nothing that she kept completely hidden. She was certainly willing to talk about this loss. But one of the things that I think about so often is, what was it like for the typical parent in, for instance, the early 1950s to suffer this kind of loss before the age of the internet and Facebook and other means by which people could easily connect with others who had suffered a similar loss. And of course, it's certainly true that she had very strong circles of friendship within her own life. In fact, probably exceptionally so. But in terms of being able to connect with others who had had this particular loss, that was something that I should think was all but impossible back then. I wonder how much you think about that when you think about what Compassionate Friends offers now and what was once possible to do for people who had suffered such a loss.
You know, that's very interesting, because my own grandmother had lost two children, and she would frequently, you know, speak of those two children. And my mom was an only child, not by choice, but because of the death of two siblings that were very young at the time. And I think of her often now, thinking that, you know, I understand now the reasons that she would bring them up. I think of children's, you know, funerals that we've been to, and that often we've gone and we've said those words that, if you ever need anything, call us. And I thought I was doing the right thing at the time, and I really meant that. However, you know, as a piece of advice for individuals, if you have a friend, an acquaintance, a coworker, you know, you almost have to be proactive in, you know, saying, let's go for coffee, and just giving them a moment. And it doesn't always have to be that, you know, you bring it up. It doesn't always have to be that you say something. Sometimes just being there and listening is all that's needed. Sometimes it's just a hug. So I think that, you know, in today's world, we're a bit more disconnected, even though we know more about each other than we ever did. We don't have that one-on-one connection. So please, if you have a friend or family member, reach out to them and don't try to fix them. There is no fix. You know, don't try to use those cliches like they're in a better place. You know, God needed another angel. While those sound comforting, it's not comforting to the parent or grandparent or sibling, because it's like, but I wanted them here. I didn't want to lose them that soon, and I really miss them. So, you know, just being there. I had some friends that sent Schwann's, you know, the home delivery guys of food, and they did pot pies and tomato soup delivered to my home because they were at a distance. That was a wonderful gesture. So, you know, be proactive with your friends or family or acquaintances and reach out to them. Sometimes just, you know, tapping them on the shoulder, letting them know, I'm thinking of you. And if you can, recall a story of their loved one. Say their loved one's name. It is so important. That is music to our ears. And people often say, oh, I didn't mean to make you cry. And it's okay. You know, those are tears of love, of what we remember. You haven't made us sad. We are going to be sad regardless. So please, mention their name and recall some stories.
Mm. I should think that another word of encouragement you have is, I mean, not only to the bit about avoiding cliches and so on. I mean, people certainly can say the wrong thing while meaning well, But on the other hand, to shrink back entirely because you're so afraid of saying something wrong or saying too much is probably even worse. I mean, that people need to, in a sense, be brave when it comes to somebody in their life who has suffered this loss, if they possibly can, need to somehow find the courage to speak up and say something, even if it's very, very little, even if it's very, very simple. In fact, probably very little and very simple are the best things to say. But to say nothing at all is worse.
Yes, that's absolutely right. We love to hear their name. We really do. And, you know, it just what people end up saying is that it's like the world has forgotten them. No one says their name. No one wants to talk about them. Some will even say, aren't you over this yet? No, we'll never be over this. We lost a child, for heaven's sakes. You know, they'll be with us forever. Just because they died doesn't mean our love for them died. Just as people with living children like to recount childhood stories or favorite tales, we like to do the same thing. But oftentimes what happens, you know, I'll mention a Tony story and, you know, it brings a chuckle to my face, some of his antics. And, you know, and you look around and you've made people uncomfortable. And so you start to not say those or tell those stories. So, you know, thank people. I'm glad you told me that story about Tony. I didn't know that. You know, just an acknowledgement that it's okay to talk about them.
I heard something just in the last day or two that I found quite remarkable, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to ask you about this. This was the opportunity to hear former Vice President Joe Biden reading or reciting from his recently published memoir called Promise Me, Dad, which is largely the story of him losing his son. And Mr. Biden says at one point something to the effect that in the immediate wake of his son's death, every thought of him immediately brought tears. And now he's gotten to the point where when he thinks of his son, the first thing he does is smile. And then often tears follow right thereafter. But now the memories of his son, I mean specific memories of wonderful moments or something, his own reaction to those memories is somehow happier, or at least there's happiness and gratitude combined with, of course, also that sadness and sorrow that's always there. I wonder if that sounds familiar to you, as, for instance, you have continued to grieve the death of your son, Tony. If the memories of Tony, if in a sense the flavor of those memories have changed over the years in a way that is positive.
Absolutely. You know, and I love Joe Biden's. I think his quote is something like, as you said, my wish for you is that their memory will bring a smile to your face rather than a tear to your eye, and that time will come. And that time has come for me where when I first think of Tony, you know, it's recalling some happy memory. And, you know, that's not to say that Tony was perfect. He wasn't. I chuckle at some of his antics. But, you know, you do get to that point. But again, it is hard work, and you have to allow yourself to do that. You have to allow yourself to first have those tears, because I remember early in my grief wondering, will there ever be a day that I don't cry every day for months and months and months, every day? Each day a little less, but every day nonetheless, I cried. And I just thought, the rest of my life, I'm going to cry every day. And I can assure you that I don't. I still have tears, but I have smiles now before I have those tears often. So you will get there. I promise you, with grief work, with talking to others, with retelling the story, not only of what happened, but also of their lives, you will get there. You know, for the moms that have miscarried or had a child born sleeping, I feel very badly because I had 29 years to remember. For those families, you know, just recalling the happiness and the anticipation, picking a name for your child if you had that opportunity, you know, recalling those memories are what you need to work on. It's okay to remember. I remember when I was pregnant with Tony that, you know, and you recall that memory. Those are good things that you'll start to remember. So it is hard work, and don't have expectations on yourself that you think there's something wrong with me. All I do is cry. It's okay. It's your body, your emotions, your brain kind of putting things together and making sense of the world again. I promise you, you'll get there as long as you work at it. But don't isolate yourself. Don't hide your loved one from the world. I consider it my job now so that people know about Tony and know that he existed and know that he made a difference. He's making a difference today. Through his death, I've learned so much. He taught me in life, and he has taught me in his death.
Hmm. So for people who have not yet been part of Compassionate Friends, even though they have suffered such a loss, how is it that they can find Compassionate Friends and become part of this?
Sure. So all you have to do, if you go online to CompassionateFriends.org, you can turn in a request at our website, and we'll send you a packet of information. We ask a number of questions to find out which one of our brochures would be most helpful for you, and then we'll also send any local information. If you don't have access to the internet, or you're more comfortable with calling, or you want to call for a friend, our phone number is 877-969-0010. And we'll, again, we'll be happy to send you some informational brochures, talk about grieving, talk about the loss. Helpful tidbits. We'll also give you information on where your nearest chapter is. We can send you a sheet on the names of those 25 closed Facebook pages. And then I just want to bring up again, this Sunday, December 10th, Compassionate Friends hosts a worldwide candle lighting. You don't have to go anywhere to do that. At 7 p.m., whatever time zone you're in, throughout the world, people will be lighting candles for their loved ones gone too soon. It just gives us that pause in a very busy season to stop and remember our loved ones.
Hmm. Debbie Rambus is Executive Director of the Compassionate Friends. Debbie Rambus, thank you so much for being part of the morning show today, and very best wishes to you and everyone who is part of Compassionate Friends.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And now for something a bit more lighthearted, I'm really excited to be able to connect with a very, very talented writer by the name of Chris Harris. And you may know the name Chris Harris because he has made a number of appearances on NPR, particularly with NPR's Scott Simon. You might also be familiar with the wonderful, quirky comedy How I Met Your Mother, for which Chris Harris served as executive producer. Chris Harris also has written for The David Letterman Show, but what we're talking about today is none of those things, but rather yet another great children's book that comes from Chris Harris, this one, the most recent, called I'm Just No Good at Rhyming and Other Nonsense for Mischievous Kids and Immature Grown-Ups. And I'm very excited to speak with Chris Harris about this book and some of what has fueled his interest in creating these kind of books for the public. Chris Harris, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. And wow, like that, when you list everything that I've done like that, it makes me feel like I've actually done something with my life. Thank you so much. I've got all these negative voices in my head all the time, and you just like threw them onto their heels.
Well, so good. That's what deserves to happen to them. So it is really an interesting resume that you have, and it ranges far and wide. And there's plenty of things on your resume that wouldn't maybe necessarily scream children's author. How do we tie all of this together? I mean, does this all spring from the same sense of humor, or does your work as a children's author really sort of emanate from a different place?
Well, I love that question. In a way, it does. You know, we're all the products of what we grew up with and what we grew up loving. And for me, absolutely, in terms of the children's books, of course, I love Shel Silverstein and Lewis Carroll and Phantom Tollbooth, but later on, things like Letterman, where I got to write, and Monty Python, and I've been thinking about that question, and I think there is this common thread of let's try to look at things from an angle that people haven't looked at before. Let's try to do something that puts a twist on convention. And I've been lucky enough to work on shows like Letterman and How I Met Your Mother, where they do play with the form. And in a way, with this book, once I had my own kids, I wanted to write something for them, and I was, you know, too exhausted to think of anything except for short form poetry. And in a way, I was taking all those things that have made me laugh and the styles that I've written before and bringing them to my kids. And that's why in this book there is a lot of playing with the form and let's look at things from a different angle and let's try things that haven't been done. It was all to make my own kids laugh and to show them all the amazing things that you can do with words.
Mm.
And now I'm lucky enough that I get a lot of other people can experience it too.
I want to steal a question from NPR's own Scott Simon. I know that when he spoke to you, one of the things he asked you is whether or not you yourself had or even have some sort of aversion to poetry or find poetry sort of intimidating or off-putting. I mean, what's your own relationship to poetry been?
Well, that's as I remember it, I completely flubbed the answer, but I'm ready this time, Greg. I'm ready. Because Scott mentioned it, and even the cover of the book says, oh, do you think you hate poetry? Then this is the book for you. But from my memory and also from my experience of going around to schools and babbling in front of kids, when you're in second or third or fourth or fifth grade, you don't hate poetry. Maybe that happens in 10th grade when you have to get to the more complicated stuff. But from what I can tell, people are still at that age excited about it. And I think it's the rhythms, and I think it's the feeling of setup punchline that certain poems can have. You know, 'tis better to give something than to receive it. If that thing's a black eye, then yeah, I believe it. Yeah, I feel like there's just something sort of natural to that rhythm that kids do like. So, you know, in a way, I'm just not even sure that it's that's how kids look at poetry. I know that I, when I was growing up, I loved Shel Silverstein. I loved Ogden Nash. I couldn't get enough of how perfect they were, like the American version of haikus. And then, like I said, all these other experiences and influences brought me to this book.
So explain to our listeners, if they open up this book, what they're going to find.
Hopefully they'll find a lot of things that make them laugh and make a kid or grandkid also laugh. And I've also been talking a lot recently about how, laughter can be a gateway emotion. Once you're laughing with somebody, then you can feel free to open up a little bit. And again, I wrote these over the years to make my own kids laugh, but also a few poems in there, I try to slip in some serious stuff because I wanted them to know, I get that it's not always easy being a kid. You know, it's like for an adult, share your cookie with your sibling is the easiest thing in the world, but to a kid, that's like a tragedy of Shakespearean proportions. And there's another poem that starts out, I'm shy on the outside, but inside my head, I'm not at all shy. I'm outgoing instead. And I feel like that was an emotion that I remember feeling as a kid and I've seen in other kids. And so, there's a lot of laughter. Hopefully there's some things to think about. And then also I want to show kids that, I'm an author is not some lofty, impossible to reach presence. The writer of this book is throughout the book, he's just a giant mess. You know, the title poem, I'm just no good at rhyming, it makes me feel so bad, I'm just no good at rhyming, and that's why I'm so blue. You know, it's all about showing the kids that I'm totally fallible. I make a mistake misspelling the word mistake. I get into a fight with my illustrator. And what I hope is that they come away from this thinking, oh, I can write a book too. This guy's a mess. This guy's a bozo, and he wrote a book. I wonder what I can do. I just remember thinking that over and over again growing up. With the influences that I talked about, like reading something and thinking, "Wow, I didn't know you could do that. I wonder what I can do."
Hmm.
I hope other kids experience that too.
Right. I know that you, at least in large measure, really wrote this either for your kids or with your kids in mind. Did they have any tangible role in the creation of this book? I mean, for instance, would you sort of try things out on them to see if they laughed or see if they yawned or somewhere in between?
Totally. They were guinea pigs, and if things didn't work, then I'd go back to the drawing board. They were sort of my own test audience. But also a lot of the there are also poems in there that came about from experiences that we had together. I remember when my daughter Josie was three, she was refusing to eat her eggs, and it was like 5:30 in the morning or something, and I, out of exhaustion, I resorted to that parental cliche, eat your breakfast, it's the most important meal of the day. And without missing a beat, she looked up at me and she said, "That's not very nice to lunch." And I thought, oh my gosh, she's right. From the perspective of lunch, that must be a really hurtful thing. And so that became a poem. It's called "Just Because I'm a Turkey Sandwich and Some Chips Doesn't Mean I Don't Have Feelings Too," you know. And not to be confused with the poem of the same title by Lord Byron.
Right.
It's a mixture of ideas we had. You know, the kids. Another example of the kids all for a while. She was just naming her stuffed animal. Every stuffed animal she had, she was just giving the same name. And so that became a poem about an island where everyone's Toby. So it is they are personal to me. Some of them seem very silly. They are woven into the book.
Mm. The book, again, is I'm Just No Good at Rhyming and Other Nonsense for Mischievous Kids and Immature Grown-Ups, of which Chris Harris would appear to be one. It's written by Chris Harris, illustrated by Lane Smith. It's a delight start to finish. Chris Harris, thank you for making time for this, and thank you for giving the world this delightful book.
Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye. As we approach 9 o'clock, we want to remind you of the Wisconsin Public Radio's year-end pledge drive. If you appreciate the programming you hear over Wisconsin Public Radio and WGTD, please call them at 1-888-202-2552.